Our theories are traditionally constructed from our accounts of adult psychopathology. And most children, much of the time, are having a different kind of experience. And our theories tend to be more symbolic, they tend to be more negative, and they paint a more stressful and dreary picture of childhood.
Thanks very much for joining with me, Stephen.
It's a pleasure.
I'm interested in what made you want to become a psychotherapist.
I guess in the first place, I was someone who wanted to be helpful to people. I suppose as a young man in college and before and after, I liked having deep or intimate conversations with people, and the idea that I could be helpful and get paid and make a living doing that was appealing to me. I was weighing between being a political, some kind of activist, and being a psychotherapist. And I came of age at a time when the new left in the late 60s and early 70s was losing in influence, and so it seemed best eventually to become a therapist. I think that there are other kinds of things. It, on the one hand, it seemed to be a field that would be of enough intellectual and conceptual interest to sustain that side of my character. I suppose another part of it is that, on a personal level, I've come to see that my mother, whom I love dearly, had an anxious and depressed side of which I was dimly aware. And I suppose that the organization of something that I could do that could help people with their emotional lives also involved some solution for me to some deep and not too bad psychological issue that I carried with me.
Yeah. You've described yourself as an emissary from one world of expertise to another. It's interesting, isn't it?
I find it quite interesting. Mm. Yeah, I find it interesting to be able to think along several lines to try to bridge the information and thinking styles from one world to another. Mm. I think it's easy to get stuck in your own silo and your own culture. Mm. And I think that learning from one area to another is vitalizing. I also think that we do better work as clinicians, psychotherapeutic clinicians, when we are able to borrow and shift and see different aspects of the mind and the body too, because these matters are so complicated and present in so many ways that if we just look at it from one perspective, we're going to lose the forest for our particular group of trees. If we can retain, as analysts and therapists, if we can retain our interest in that deep mind, but also learn about all the other aspects of reality and development that are important, we can serve our clients better, especially children.
Your latest book really is a contribution to a relational development psychoanalytic viewpoint.
I think so.
So let's drill down a little bit on that and what those three different elements mean. So I know that the relational school established by Stephen Mitchell has had quite a big effect on your thinking. Can you tell me about that?
Well, first of all, in terms of my development as an analyst, the relational school came along at a very important time. Mm-hmm. I found myself aware of the relational school at a time in my training when I felt quite fond of psychoanalysis and committed to it, but also constrained by some of the rigidities of the field. And relational analysis, coming along as it did in the 1980s, offered a more flexible and open stance, both with regard to theory and to contact with adjacent disciplines, and most important in regard to clinical work. The relational psychoanalysis acknowledged the contribution of the analyst's character and personality, rejected certain conventions that had the quality of restricting the range of the analyst's responsiveness, and instead encouraged us to acknowledge that we were humans involved with other humans, and to have a social understanding of development and of psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. All of these things seemed intuitively right to me, and also supported by all kinds of emerging science as well as philosophy.
So alongside this relational aspect of your work, there's a developmental one.
Yes.
What does developmental mean to you?
Well, it's I'd say it means a lot, but I'm interested in the capacity of people and of systems to change over time, sometimes for the worse, but often for the better. And I believe that there are natural potentials in humans, and indeed in animals, particularly though in humans, to adapt and to increase vitality and to increase one's ability to include more information and more energy from the world around them. And that's most visible in the development of children. Children change faster. They're in some respects more flexible. They are for better when things are good and for worse when things are bad. To respond to changes in their environment, and all of that has made my has affected my thinking about psychotherapy. It's been important to include those principles as I've proceeded, also as a psychoanalyst interested in the conventional, traditional aspects of psychoanalysis. It means that a consciousness of the potentials of the future have become important to me alongside understanding the restrictions from the past. And it also means understanding the vital influence of bodily experience and bodily change, which we see so vividly in childhood, at all phases of the lifespan.
And intersubjectivity, this is an important part of your latest book and of your work.
Yes.
As well.
Yes. Well, in short, I think that an intersubjective perspective starts from the notion that individuals are who they are by virtue of their relationship to other people, and that from the point of view of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, that's led me very much to think in terms of the relationship between the environment and the individual, and particularly to think in terms of the importance of relationships in shaping who we are at every moment. We're different people with each different person and in each environment. We're also the same person. And that paradox is at the heart of how I understand that intersubjectivity concept. That there's a kind of continuous interplay between the individual, between the self, between one's own body and others and the surround and the environment. It's a little bit like breathing, let's say. You can't think of breathing without thinking both of the lungs and the air. They're inseparable. And an intersubjective perspective says the same, that we as individuals cannot be conceiving of ourselves and can't be conceived of without reference to our world, and in particular, other people. Now, there are many, many nuances to this, but that's the short, I think, rendition of it.
So how can this relational, developmental, and intersubjective aspects be helpful to people working with children, not just psychotherapists?
Well, I think there are so many ways. I think one aspect of it is that we do well to be aware of our own experience and our own contribution to whatever situation we're involved in. Since we communicate so much of who we are through feelings, and through non-verbal channels, it also brings attention both in psychotherapy and elsewhere to feelings, and the extent to which feelings are communicated and shared very rapidly and also without reflection. It also means that we do well to be aware of how we are affected by the others around us and by the institutions within which we work, whether we're psychotherapists or teachers or principals or even in the political or social sphere. We are, as humans, receptive both to people's pleasure and also to their suffering, and not to be ashamed of our responsiveness, but in fact to understand our responsiveness as a resource and as something we can share with colleagues as a routine part of our work, whether we're in a school or a child welfare program or in a psychotherapy practice or in a medical clinic, because you understand yourself as not simply as someone on your own responsible for everything, but rather as someone who finds herself in a network of influence with many other people. And if you can approach that with a spirit of generosity for yourself and for others, you can have a more open and responsive stance.
Mm-hmm. So emotions really lie at the heart of this.
Emotions and reflection and a notion of our constant interchange with others. But I would give emotions tremendous attention. Mm-hmm. Yes. Emotions are by their very... Let me say two things about emotions. One thing we know about emotions now in the way they've been studied in the last decades is that emotions are simultaneously individual and social. And it's in the nature of emotion that they both affect us internally. They change our blood chemistry changes, our brains change, our skin tone changes, and we, as that happens, we display our emotions in ways that are visible to others, and the others who observe emotions are immediately affected. There's a remarkable finding that shows that someone who observes another's emotions will have changes in their brain that reflect that emotion at speeds of a few hundredths of a second. And that speed is faster than perception can go. That is, these changes are faster than you can notice them. That suggests that often we are in a dialogue with other people through emotions at the same time that we're in communication with ourselves through emotion.
What I love about your book is how much there's a synthesis between your understanding of the scientific literature as well as theory. And my interest is really about what the possibilities are about how this can apply to interventions with children. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that the science supports the long-time view of psychoanalysts and parents that what happens in the early years is very much influential and is probably the most influential in terms of the long run. I want to mention a striking example of that. There's a Nobel Prize-winning labor economist, James Heckman, who has studied the effect of intervention in the first 18 years of life and correlated it with the effect of those interventions on labor productivity and other similar economically salient outcomes at age 30. And he finds that there's a linear relationship between the earliness of intervention and the effect on variables such as labor productivity. That means simply that the earlier you intervene, the greater the effect that you will have later. That's a remarkable finding because it's not from a clinician. It's from someone who's concerned about labor productivity and who's one of the greats in the world at that. Now, we also know that the brain develops fastest in the first year of life and in similarly in the first few years of life. And that's remarkable, and it's remarkable to watch as a parent. It's remarkable to watch if you look at brain images. That means, and finally, we know that relationships with other humans and with caregivers are the best predictors of outcome subsequently in development. And we know that development in the early years depends on emotional conditions, such as positive a preponderance of positive emotion, a secure attachment, and a secure sense of self. What that means is that we can be confident that if we intervene into caregiving relationships early and provide support for parents generally, that we're going to do well and we're going to have the greatest leverage. That's also important for social policy because it means that early intervention will save our taxpayers quite a lot of money. Since we know that relationships are really where the action is, we can intervene. We know that we should intervene in relationships, paying attention to interaction, the quality of attachment, helping parents be as responsive and caring with their children as possible. And this is, in a way, what every mother knows, many with many exceptions, and it's what analysts have said for a long time.
And where does attachment theory come into this?
Well, attachment theory is very important. Attachment theory and research, first of all, was probably the first of the serious attempts, of those many attempts that we've discussed. Attachment theory in the hands of John Bowlby and then Mary Main represent the first efforts to really say, let's look at the relationship and let's take the baby mother relationship, the baby caregiver relationship, as the core of motivation. And as Bowlby said, he said the child's tie to the mother is as important to motivation as sex or hunger. And when Bowlby said that, it was a radical thought for his day, very important historically. Attachment research is among the most powerful research that shows that early care is predictive of psychological security, not only in the adulthood of the young baby, but in the children of that baby when she or he becomes a parent. So attachment theory is a very, very important base. Some people, here's one caution, I say this with full respect to attachment theory. Some people talk about the whole of early infant development research using the term attachment theory or attachment research. And I hope that instead everyone will understand that the rich body of knowledge that's emerged from Bowlby's description of attachment and the subsequent description of the attachment categories and so on is one area, but that there are others.
Yeah, I know that you'd be aware of the rivalry between people who support attachment theory and, say, the Kleinians, and for some, it's either or.
And
what I find really interesting is that you're saying it's and.
Yes.
And that I know that you write about Klein and the influence of Klein and how important it is to know about her theories. And yet some people will say, well, how can you possibly like Klein and also be committed to, say, infancy work?
Yes. Well, I think that, first of all, we have to say that one thing about theory in analysis is that there is sensitive, very sensitive and tuned in therapists who are working with one or another of the wide variety of clinical approaches. And the first thing is that no matter what the clinical approach, the sensitivity and engagement and care of the therapist is really where the action is in particular in psychodynamic psychotherapy. It's generally true, and even in other kinds of psychotherapy, the quality of the relationship is the strong predictor of outcome. Now, I find the work of Mrs. Klein and her followers extremely helpful in an array of clinical situations. And there are all kinds of binds that I find that my patients are involved in and I'm involved in the transference and the countertransference that have been illuminated by Kleinian psychoanalysis. And I teach a number of situations in which I try to teach Klein, sometimes Winnicott, but Klein to relational analysts who've been almost phobic about Klein. And they end up feeling, I'm proud to say, that they're really finding something in their clinical work about particularly post-traumatic situations where people attack themselves and they attack others and they're caught up in their omnipotence and so on and so on. And so I think it's tremendously clinically valuable and compelling. It helps with turbulent countertransferences of all sorts.
You've written that, "I feel that analysts are not always committed to thinking about real children."
I do think that.
What are they thinking about then?
Well, sometimes analysts are caught up in ways that can be productive, but often get in our way in our theories about children. And our theories are traditionally constructed from our accounts of adult psychopathology. And most children, much of the time, are having a different kind of experience. And our theories tend to be more symbolic, they tend to be more negative, and they paint a more stressful and dreary picture of childhood. Even the ones that don't capture the physical and emotional vitality and even stresses of actual childhood, and they isolate the child from his or her surround. So we need to continue to think in terms of our very powerful and colorful theories, our ideas about infantile fantasy and childhood motivations and the dependency of children and so on. But we also need to have pictures of real children in our mind. And that's especially true, of course, when we work with children. Now, child psychotherapists, I think, are less limited in this regard because we have to deal with children all the time, and child psychotherapists therefore bring a great deal to the practice of adult psychoanalysis and psychotherapy.
I know that one of the most important aspects of your work is commitment to working with parents.
Yes.
And that's really seeing children in their own environments, isn't it?
Yes, I think so.
And I think you're really quite influenced by Selma Freiberg's infant parent program. She's
yes.
the author of Ghosts in the Nursery.
Yes.
And you started working in her department in 1981.
Yes. I worked there and we worked, and the program still continues, we worked at the homes of families, seeing the relationship as the patient as we intervened on behalf of babies never older than three. And what seemed most important was to understand the parents and to build an alliance with the parents, since we might spend an hour or two or even three a week with the family, while the parents spend the full week with the parent, with the babies. And so that it seemed to us there that it was important to see the relationship as the area where change was going to take place. And so I always make the greatest effort to build and sustain an alliance with the parents, to let the parents know that our goal is to find an image and an understanding of the child which is shared, to not treat them as someone subordinate that I have to teach, but as full partners and indeed the CEOs of the operation, because indeed they are by law and by influence. And all of that has been vital in my work. There's an important aspect of children coming to psychotherapy with regard to the parents' feelings about the problem. And parents feel, conscientious parents, or somewhat conscientious parents, feel all kinds of negative feelings when they bring their child to psychotherapy. They feel shame, they feel guilt, they feel like a failure. And also, at times, their negative projections, their destructive projections, have taken hold. And so they may have, for all those reasons, lost sight of the extent to which they've been good parents, or even when they've been damaging parents, they through projection, blame the child for their for having made them feel bad, and this is usually an unconscious process. So I'm interested in using my position as a helpful person, or as an authority, or whatever other transferences develop, to try to provide a balance to some of the negativity. And so it's not only a matter of understanding what's wrong, which is important, but also putting it in the context of the larger interest and care which has brought the parents to bring their child to psychotherapy in the first place. And this can be extremely moving, both to the parents and to me. And this can be the recovery of something, which is extremely important.
Can you describe a case?
Oh, without, sure.
Bearing in mind anonymity.
Yeah, I worked with an African American family in San Francisco for 2 years, meeting with them weekly in their home. And they had been accused of abusing their child, in a little girl who was 18 months old at the beginning of the case. And they were accused of burning her in the bathtub. After investigation, it turned out that it was an uncle who had done this, and the child was not removed. But the mother, in particular, was still very uncertain and given to self-doubt, irritation, and even anger. I brought a set of crayons, and washable crayons, and I brought a pack of paper. So she started to scribble, and I invited her mother to scribble rather than to scribble along with her. And her mother scribbled with her, and then she scribbled back, and they began to have a very enjoyable time. Now, one thing about this mom is that she wasn't much of a player. She was conscientious enough, but she wasn't much of a player. And they began to laugh together. And I just stood back as an observer. And at some point I asked, "Mom, what did this feel like?" And she said, or I might have said, "You seem to be enjoying yourselves." And the mom became quite tearful. And she said, "No one ever did this with me." And it was a remarkable moment. She then, when I continued to come back, I found them playing together. So there's something in this moment in which the opportunity to do something different, perhaps my deferring to the mother, allowed her to take a different stance. I wasn't there to teach her daughter to draw or to scribble. I was there to try to help the mom find as much of her resources as I could. And that attitude seemed to potentiate a change which could then be multiplied through the power of the emotion and through this new way of relating that they had. And that is really just what I would hope to have happened in a situation like this.
And do you think that's illustrative of this developmental stance?
Oh, my Lord, yes, because in many, many ways, but it too can be highlighted. One is that somehow I would view the situation as having mobilized a certain kind of developmental mode, a progressive developmental mode, scribbling or playing or idle activity, is something apparently less conscientious. That was of tremendous value in terms of enhancing and accelerating and broadening this child's development. And indeed, not only the child's growth, but also the mother's growth as a mother, because after all, adults develop too. And second, it's important to understand the way that people and children at different ages use different modes of relating and different modes of processing information. So here, as a three-year-old, the capacity to be playful was a crucial developmental mode. And when Mom and I came to know that and came to know that together, something very special happened. If she had sat down to teach her to write, she would have been off the developmental timetable. Mm-hmm. So I think of development here both as a kind of forward movement and also in terms of a knowledge about how the worlds of children and adults, but particularly children, vary depending on their age and development. And if you know that, you are better able to adapt and communicate.
I'm wondering whether there have been particular cases that you've worked with, adults or children, that you have found to be particularly transformative.
Well, in one of my earliest analytic cases, in supervision, I followed the advice of a supervisor to not accept a gift from a patient. And I'd say that analysis turned out to have limited effect. Now, not accepting the gift was not the only reason. There are many other reasons. But when the patient terminated, the patient said that that ever since I failed to accept the gift, that it was not possible to trust me in the same way. And I think I learned something. I think at that point, something changed in me such that I came to feel that when in doubt, be forthcoming. And when in doubt, don't be a skinflint about engaging. So that would be one example.
It's interesting you should say about that. Similarly, when I was training, a parent I was working with gave me a gift too, which I refused, and she was very offended, and yeah. She brought it back again.
Good.
she wanted me to have this gift, and I learned so much from it too. And I think what I learned, and I was thinking about the relational approach, that actually she had something to give me.
Yes.
It was symbolic.
Yes.
And of course she did. She gave me so much. I learned so much about working with parents.
Yes.
through her generosity, not just in giving me this gift,
yes,
but her generosity in so many other ways, in sharing her thoughts and her ideas as well as her sorrows with me and
yes,
her difficulties.
Well, that is a gift. I mean, it is an extraordinary gift, yeah, to have patients tell you
yeah,
about themselves.
Yeah.
And when they care for you, it's very special.
Yeah.
I learned a great deal about talking about cultural matters, mm, in cases at the Infant Parent Program where I was working with families, that African-American families that were required to be in therapy with our group because of allegations of child abuse. And I came to feel that it was essential, it was important to be prepared to talk about our differences in race, in power, in our place in the bureaucracy. I remember one case where I was visiting the home of an African American man, and his partner was a white woman, and he was a member of a strong municipal workers union, and he had been kept from the care of his daughter for bad reasons, really. And he was very angry, and it was clear that some of it had to do with me being this white guy who was coming in and having to decide what could happen to his daughter. And at first I was ashamed to talk about that, and then I at some point said, and what I would now say rather directly, that he must be completely troubled and furious to have some white guy come into his house when he'd invite me into his house and to be the one who was deciding whether he could see his daughter more than twice a week. And he was a bit relieved, and I was very relieved. And so that made a difference in my practice. I think that there are cases where an example of a case would be a recent case where I was speaking with the mother he's a 9-year-old, and she she has good intentions about her son, but she's rather rigid. And when she when he commits infractions, like talks to his friends for an additional 45 seconds before he jumps in the car at the school pickup, she lectures him on his arrival. And then she and I were speaking, and I asked her what it was that she thought was so important. And I said it in a way that I believe she felt was not a didactic question, but an honest question. And she said that she was, that's how she was raised. And I asked her what it was like. And in the course of talking about it for a few minutes, she became tearful and remembered something about how she would often feel humiliated. And that led her, in certain ways, to soften her approach to her son. And that was and is an example of a kind of case in which work with the parents and work with the parents' experience as children, as determinants of their experience of their parents, is shown to be so important.
Your book, your new book, Relationships and Development, there's quite a lot of section about the evolution of the idea of childhood in the history of psychoanalysis, mm-hmm. especially in regard to infancy and development itself. Why did you feel it was important to write about that?
Well, I think in general history is important, and I think that we do well to remember our history. Mm-hmm. I started by planning to write a book about the image of the infant that's emerged today from the direct observation of babies by researchers like Daniel Stern or Colin Trevarthen. And that research shows that the baby is social and interested in relationships and influential and that sort of thing. And I was concerned that today's generation of psychoanalysts would either throw out the old analytic baby with the bathwater, or on the other hand, that they would feel that they somehow had to choose between the two. Now, I think there's tremendous value to the analytic images of the infant as irrational and dependent. All of us think the baby's dependent. Irrational, dependent, thinking in different ways, very much oriented by something that we might call fantasy, and so on. I thought that would be important to bring out. That said, I think that the old images are not actually images of babies, by and large. They're not accurate. And so I was interested also in trying to take a look at the nature of psychoanalytic discourse and to try to explore the possibilities of understanding psychoanalytic discourse as a kind of imaginative discourse, which could be useful because, after all, the subject of psychoanalysis, from my point of view, is something like the imagination. So I wanted to tell the story, and I wanted to tell the story in a way that respected the analytic imagination, and that told my readers how we got to this, at the same time that I wanted to say that's useful, but not in the way that some of us might have taken it to be useful.
So you're not saying that what we should do, it's not either or. Are you saying it's and, so that we can learn,
yes,
hugely from Freudian thoughts, ideas, theory, whilst actually adapting it to what we know about the latest scientific research.
Well, and just about, yes, so I think it's, we can learn a great deal from the Freudian theory and the Kleinian theory and the Winnicottian theory and so on, especially if we understand those as telling us a lot about what happens to people under distress mm-hmm. and what happens to people after trauma. Mm-hmm. With that mind shift, I think we have a very, very rich resource for understanding adults and to some extent to understanding very young children. So yes, I think that's right. And I think we strengthen those ideas if we limit the claim that we make and say, these are very powerful clinical accounts, and we don't say, this is what babies are like most of the time. And I'm very much a fan of clearing up that kind of confusion.
Can you say more about that?
Yeah, because I think a problem with certain kind of analytic discourse is that we end up making inferences about things that we don't have enough information to make inferences about. That's right. That's something we do clinically a little bit, and sometimes it's helpful. We float some idea about the patient's past, and then we have a dialogue about it. But when we make generalizations about how certain things actually are, when we say this is what it's like to be a baby, because we use the metaphor of a baby with our patients in a way that may or may not be effective, then we've crossed the line into imposing our theory or our clinical experience or both onto other domains of life. And this actually weakens us in the rest of the world, because people look at us and they say, well, this part of analysis isn't right. We don't see the drives in the brain or whatever. And or this isn't what babies are like. I reject psychoanalysis. If we make more careful use of what we know, we're going to be stronger in discourse with other people. And also our clinical work will get stronger because we'll know what we're doing better. I don't think we should rely on empirical science as the only source of support or refutation for what we do. And I want to make that very clear, because here and in the book I do a lot of reference to observational science, and I don't think that's the only source of validation. We have philosophy, we have psychoanalysis itself, we have all sorts of social studies of all kinds. Mm-hmm. And psychoanalysis is a human science. Mm-hmm. However, I think that at this point, with regard to the consilience and correlation between psychoanalysis and empirical observation, we can say that certain things that we have assumed or we have stressed are very much backed up. The idea of the unconscious or of unconscious thinking is strongly supported by cognitive neuroscience. The idea that relationships and feelings are important is strongly supported by neuroscience. There are other ideas that we have and things that we believe that are not so supported. For example, the idea that the infant is engaged in is driven by irrational instincts of the sort that Freud and Klein and others described. That idea doesn't seem to hold up when one looks at babies, in my opinion. And so what we're able to do now is to discriminate between which of our ideas are supported by what observations, and from that platform we can return to our own discourse and ask better questions.
It seems to me you're a big fan of nuance.
I think so.
You're smiling.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, it's a grace and a burden and a pain in the ass. Not for myself. I mean, it's a pain in the ass for other people. I enjoy it a great deal. But someone has to do it. I mean, I think that empirical science has been criticized, I think correctly, for avoiding making generalizations. And I think that's right, at least, you know, and I think the translation from empirical science to clinical practice, whether in medicine or in psychotherapy, is a matter partly of taking particular findings and doing something with them. But I think that, on the other hand, psychoanalysis, psychoanalytic theories make a number of generalizations which lack nuance. And I think that I'm not comfortable with that, you know, as an intellectual, but also I think that it leads to a fair amount of confusion. And most of all, it leads to clumsy clinical work sometimes, because if we're too driven by our generalities, then we lose what we can learn from the details, and we don't make as much contact with the patient as we can.
And I know that you've described therapists adhering to one theoretical tradition,
yes,
for example, Kleinians or Freudians,
yes,
as gratifying themselves narcissistically.
I think that when we confuse our personal needs with the pursuit of the truth, we run the risk of having our personal needs obscure our conceptual and clinical acuity. Now, I think absolutely at the same time that that kind of mix of one's personality and one's clinical efforts and intellectual efforts is inevitable, particularly in psychodynamic work and in any psychotherapeutic work, because you're always personally implicated. You're always involved from your heart and your personality. But I think that in psychoanalytic institutions have a particular quality at times, in which the cultures are built around identifications, the belonging to a culture, and our cultures have become organized to some extent around theoretical viewpoints. And in that case, we do fall into our own local orientations at the expense of variety and at the expense of integration. It doesn't serve patients to come to them with too much of a lens.
Yeah. So it's important to think in different registers, I think, is how you've described
it. Because otherwise we end up looking for the patient that we want to see. And that means also that some analysts and psychotherapists impose their viewpoint on their patient and use languages which are not so familiar to the patient. And I think it's a priority to try to find a language that suits the patient and to create a common language.
You work also as an adult psychoanalyst, and you've written that you'd like clinicians to be more aware of how they think about their patients' childhoods and infancy in their clinical work. What has your training with children brought to your work with adults?
I think I have a lot of pictures in my mind of real children, and as a matter of fact, it's common when I'm listening to patients that I find myself having a picture in my mind of my adult patient as a child. And it's a rather peculiar kind of picture. It's not actually a picture of a child. It's something like a picture of the adult, a feeling of the adult, a kind of picture, a kind of image, a dreamlike image of the adult in a child's body, but still being her. It's a little hard to get across, but I hope you can imagine it. And I picture some version of that child's life, certain situations which are going on in the moment, even if it's just something that you'd have an adult live out, something with a partner or a job or whatnot. But I end up picturing it as a child, and I think that those images and feelings of children's bodies in motion have been very useful to me. I think that I have a kinetic sense that I've acquired from seeing children, as well as valuing that kind of introspection. I have a sense of movement and emotion that I've learned a lot about from seeing children. I've also learned something about that special language of primary process, of what analysts call primary process, that children use more than adults. And I think that I take that as a given in a way. And I think that's helped me think my way through theories. And that's one area. The other area I would say is that since with children, one has to be directly engaged. Even the most traditional child psychotherapy and child psychoanalytic approaches include direct engagement with the child, getting down on the floor, having emotions together, playing together. Therefore, I think that, like many of my child psychotherapy colleagues, I've become more comfortable becoming directly engaged, including and especially in the transference and the countertransference. And all of that is invaluable.
Relational analysis has transformed clinical technique about being more open with your patients about your own experiences. How much is that a part of your work? Do you reveal much to your patients about your own experience, about your own history?
Well, I think the first thing about relational analysis is not that relational analysts are prepared to be more open about ourselves. I think that that's true. But where I think relational analysis has had the greatest impact is that it's been the leader in convincing analysts of all persuasions to be more willing to understand their reactions to their patients as partly a reflection of their own individuality and their own subjectivity, rather than feeling, as the previous generations did, that our fundamental task was to, about our responses, was to understand them as responses to the patient rather than something which is co-created. And I think that that idea has become widespread in most, not all, but most psychoanalytic precincts. And I think that the most original and decisive contribution has come from relational psychoanalysis. With regard to self-disclosure, as you asked me about, I would say that there's wide variation in my practice and wide variation among relational analysts about the extent to which we talk about ourselves. And I am concerned that there is a caricature of relational analysis is organized around self-disclosure. My own practice is very variable in that regard. And I regard the question about revealing myself as is quite situation and case specific. Now, I must say one other thing. My training was in an essentially contemporary Freudian ego psychological institute, and my supervisors were all very senior psychoanalysts. And my impression was that more of them than not, in their actual practice, were quite comfortable telling their patients this or that about themselves, and that's not uncommon at all among senior analysts of most persuasions. And so I think there's something about relational analysis or in the notion that we can be freer, which actually is just, to some extent, is making what lots of people do public and acceptable rather than something that we have to hide from the analytic police.
You expressly comment on the contribution of women to the evolution of psychoanalysis, and I thought it was a very interesting part of the book. Because I've interviewed some of the early pioneers in child psychotherapy, women such as Iska Wittenberg and Lydia Tischler, who are in their 90s. And what you say is that these women were working with women back in the 1940s, 1950s, or even earlier, in a very different way to their male contemporaries.
Well, even earlier, so yeah. That even in pre-war Vienna, yeah. In pre-World War I Vienna, or in post-World War I Vienna, mm-hmm. especially in post-World War I Vienna, but both, the women who are interested in psychoanalysis worked with children and sometimes with women in roles which were women's roles. They were teachers, or they were you know, caregivers at home and so on. And these women were not in, some of these women, of course, were quite brilliant, and they were not trained as physicians because that wasn't very common, if allowed at all. And they weren't part of Freud's inner circle, all men. And so then these women devoted their talents instead and their profound insight, women like Melanie Klein and Anna Freud and Sabina Spielrein and Hogelmuth. And they instead adapted psychoanalysis to the world of childhood. And then somehow in the next generation, they, particularly Anna Freud and Melanie Klein here in London, became the leaders. And they brought new looks. And they brought, a lot of what they brought came from having been involved with children.
And what did they observe that the men weren't observing?
Well, I think Anna Freud observed the constant push for adaptation and development in children. And she observed the life of children in institutions of all sorts, schools and orphanages and so on. And she was very interested in that. And that led her to develop a somewhat more integrative approach to psychoanalysis, especially psychoanalysis. This was in collaboration with her interest in the structural model, of course, that ran into other kinds of problems. But I think, in short, that's a tremendous contribution, that she was one of the leaders of developmental thinking. Klein observed the extent to which you could reach children through play. Anna Freud says, in an early and admiring commentary on Melanie Klein, that Melanie Klein, in developing child psychoanalysis, found in play the way to reach children that was equivalent to the way that psychoanalysts of adults used dreams. And Melanie Klein really opened that possibility, which has led to not just child psychoanalysis technique as we know it even today, but also to worlds of understanding about the important role of children's distinctive thinking in the world and in development, as well as in psychotherapy.
And I'm interested, you also chart from that time how, beginning in the 1960s and 1970s, how there were big shifts in our understanding of babies, and particularly the people of researchers actually looking at babies. So this sort of seeing how babies were being seen slightly differently, weren't they? Were being seen in a different way by people like Meltzoff and Moore, showing these, you know, babies interacting with their caregivers and showing that babies actually were real people. And so we as a society started to shift how we saw babies as well, didn't we?
Before then, the dominant view of the baby in psychoanalysis was the baby as understood retrospectively. And so, therefore, the analogies in analysis were the baby as pathological, the baby is psychotic, the baby is disorganized. There are notable exceptions that have to be mentioned, particularly emerging mostly from the British middle group, and most conspicuously Bowlby and Winnicott, but others too. And some American ego psychologists who were looking at children, notably Erickson and an array of other observers, Sybil Escalona, in some ways, Margaret Mahler. But what happened that was different, beginning in the 70s and more in the 80s and 90s, was a more systematic effort to actually watch babies and watch very young babies. And that work focused on a careful attention to infant-parent interaction and also on the capabilities of babies. And that changed the clinical and developmental science view of the baby. It wasn't just the case that psychoanalysts had this view. Pediatricians told parents and told their students that babies were born blind. They're not. Babies are born with a focal length which optimizes their ability to focus on the face of their mothers when they're nursing, 27 centimeters. And so many corrections occurred, and the baby came to be understood as an active participant, as emotional from the beginning, as social from the beginning, and that changed the scientific world, I think, in as much as it was concerned with infants. Mm-hmm. Now, subsequently, that work has been absorbed into a certain amount of policy, public policy, and I think the United States has, as it often does, lagged behind many of the other the developed countries in this regard. But even in the United States, there are more resources dedicated to the care of young children. And I think that in the public mind, there's more interest in the care of young children. Now, let me say that also has something to do with the impact of feminism, especially second wave feminism, in which, and I don't want to speak for women, except to say that the demands of women to have what they do taken seriously has contributed to a climate in which mothering and childcare is taken more seriously. And so we have a confluence, I think, of a change in the image of the child and the infant, and a change in the political climate and cultural climate with regard to what women do. That means that this story is in some way continuous with the earlier story in psychoanalysis.
I'm really interested in what you were talking about in terms of having the freedom to move from disciplines and in the way that you work, in the way that you think. And at the same time, you've had very long associations with colleagues, decades.
Yes.
How important is that to you?
It's of tremendous value to know people in different areas, in different parts of the world, of different psychoanalytic persuasions, and with different knowledge bases, so as to see the diversity of values and the diversity of expertise, which turns out to be helpful and which turns out to lead to progress in understanding and helping people. And that's inspiring. And it's very supportive in many, many ways, as well as heartwarming and emotionally gratifying.
It's an incredibly open approach.
I try.
Mm-hmm. It's a real quality about you.
Well, that's nice to hear. Thank you.
And do you have any advice for those who are perhaps starting out in their work with children? What would your advice to them be?
I think you should be patient with yourself, and I think you should be try to find what's natural in yourself that brought you to work with children. Most people who decide to work with children aren't doing it in order to support, their ambitions to be a big star or something like that. Probably, if you're attracted to working with children, it's because you care about children. And that would be the place to begin. And that would be the element of your intelligence to trust the most. I think you should be free to play. I think you should be free to use your imagination. I think you should study psychoanalysis, because psychoanalysis is even more informative about children than it is about adults. And I think you should be always conscious of the social world.
That's a really good note to end on. Thank you very much for your time, Stephen.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
I've really enjoyed talking with you.
I feel the same way. Thank you.
Thank you.